Hi, and welcome to this week's Expert HR podcast with me, Ellie Gelder. In the second part of our podcast series on TUPE, this week we're going to look at the thorny issue of post-transfer harmonisation. What can transferees do when it comes to varying terms and conditions of transferring employees? We'll then be taking a look at the practicalities of dismissals in a TUPE situation. And I'm delighted to be joined on the phone once again by Expert HR contributing authors and TUPE specialists Patrick Brodie and Kelly Thompson of law firm RPC, who are going to run through their top tips. Hi, Patrick and Kelly.
Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Ellie.
Hi. So why are there issues around harmonising employment terms where there is a TUPE transfer?
Good question. Because of lawyers like Patrick and me. I think the first thing to remember is that employees that transfer under TUPE take with them their existing contract of employment. So they arrive on day one with their new employer carrying this kind of bag full of terms and conditions. Mm-hmm. And they're often significantly different in parts to the terms of the existing workforce that the transferee already has. And so there might be lots of good reasons why that transferee might want to harmonise those terms so they don't have different sets of conditions in operation together. The first thing to say is normal rules of contract continue to apply. So as is the case with any kind of employee and employer, you can't validly vary a contract of employment without consent in the first instance. And then on top of that, TUPE adds this extra layer of protection. So when people have transferred across under TUPE, not only do you have that need for consent, but you also have the extra hurdles that TUPE puts in place, which in broad terms make it harder to validly change an individual's terms and conditions of employment, even with their consent, where those changes relate to the TUPE transfer.
So you mentioned contractual issues. So would you say this is a legal issue and a practical issue?
I think it's both, actually, Ellie. And I say both, partly because on the legal side, organisations where they're looking to achieve a harmonisation of terms and conditions might find, because of the overlay of TUPE, that they haven't effectively made those changes. That's the legal side. But equally, there is a practical point in all of it, because absent harmonisation, some organisations might see the challenge of running essentially a two-tiered workforce with different terms and conditions as between the original group of employees as against that group of employees who transferred in.
And that can cause issues between colleagues, practical issues, as you say.
You can imagine individuals working alongside each other performing exactly the same duties and taking on the same responsibilities but being paid differently, for example.
So just explain then what the extra protection is that TUPE provides in those circumstances.
Sure, it's quite simple on one level, although very complicated in practice often. TUPE says that if you change somebody's terms and conditions and the sole or principal reason for that change is the TUPE transfer, that change is void. So even if the employee agrees to it, so in the normal kind of run of things, that would be sufficient to affect a contractual change. But even if they agree, TUPE kind of trumps that consent really and says, no, it's void, you can't rely on it. What this boils down to is harmonisation in and of itself, where there's no other reason for the change. That's going to be a change because of a TUPE transfer, and therefore it's void.
Okay, but we know that it's quite a common misconception, isn't it, that changes to terms and conditions are absolutely never allowed after a TUPE transfer.
Yeah, absolutely right. That is a common misconception, and I think that comes from that sort of simplistic sort of summary that I just gave, that harmonisation is because of a transfer and therefore it's void.
Yeah.
But you can unpick that quite quickly and find circumstances in which a change is perfectly valid and perfectly reasonable and allowable. So the first thing to say, I guess, is that changes that are completely unrelated to a TUPE transfer, they're allowed in the usual way with consent and that usual kind of process.
So just give us an example of what that might be.
So if somebody, for example, moved across to a transferee and then was later promoted into a new role, and part of that promotion for anyone who takes that role is a new set of terms and conditions that might have increased salary, longer notice period, perhaps some restrictive covenants, new benefits. That's going to be nothing to do with the transfer. That's going to be to do with that promotion that's completely unrelated. So that sort of thing continues in the normal way.
Okay.
TUPE just steps in where it's kind of caught on the transfer, if you see what
yeah.
I mean. The other thing as well is that if a change is already permitted by the employment contract, then TUPE doesn't try to step in and kind of remove the ability to exercise that term. So if you had a mobility clause, the usual rules should continue to apply to that. Bearing in mind, with those sorts of terms, you've always got the potential risk of constructive dismissal and those sorts of issues if you exercise those kinds of terms unreasonably. So all of that continues to apply. There's also a special kind of rule that was added into TUPE fairly recently to say that if you've got terms and conditions that have been incorporated from a collective agreement, so union bargain terms, they've been incorporated into individual employment contracts, once a year has passed since the transfer, those can be changed, provided that those terms, when considered together as a package, are no less favourable.
That only applies to the terms incorporated from a collective agreement.
Exactly right. Okay. So in a normal kind of individual employment contract, that isn't going to give you any help. The other allowable piece under tribute, which I think we'll come on to talk about in a bit more detail, is where your change isn't because of the transfer, but actually the main reason, or the only reason, is that you have an economic, technical or organisational reason, an ETO reason, entailing a change in the workforce, you can make that change with consent. So that could be changes related to a genuine redundancy exercise, changes related to a change in location, that kind of thing. And then just for completeness, whether a relevant insolvency proceedings at the point of the transfer, then certain changes are permitted as a relaxation to dupe in those circumstances as well.
But I think some people may assume that surely there's got to be a time period after which contract changes can be safely made.
It'd be lovely to, if that was the case, Ellie, because then at least we'd be operating in a world of certainty. But as we know probably from both this podcast but also the preceding one from last week, is dupe doesn't always come with certainty. So as the law stands, there is no fixed period beyond which making a change becomes in and of itself effective. All our courts are interested in is they ask a simple question: what is the reason for this particular change? And if the change is because of the transfer, then there is the risk of it being void and unenforceable. So to make a change, an organisation has to identify an intervening event and then attach the change to that. So that might be a redundancy, it might be a promotion, it might be, for example, a change of arrangements to improve the performance of an organisation. But absent that, the risk is, even if that change is made a number of years after the original transfer, absent an intervening event to which the change is attached, there's a real risk that the change itself becomes unenforceable.
Presumably, the longer that passage of time, the more likely that link could be severed.
I think that's right from a perception perspective, because people will be, there's an assumption that the link between the change and the transfer itself has been made.
Okay, so we've outlined the law, but I think our listeners are going to be really keen to hear how practically employers can limit the risk. So what would you advise your clients?
I think the first point is the one Patrick was just making there, that if you can realistically and truthfully detach the changes from the transfer, then that's kind of your safest route. If there is another reason and that genuinely can stack up as a reason for the changes, then you're in kind of safer ground there. Another thing practically is if you're making what might be perceived as kind of negative changes, detrimental changes, but they're part of a package where other changes are beneficial, then try from a practical perspective to link very clearly those beneficial changes to the other changes as a package, to try to avoid the risk that individuals look to accept a package and then cherry pick and say, oh, I'll keep my new benefits, but actually I think all the other changes are void. So there's practical kind of ways of trying to link them together. As a last resort, where you've got a set of critical changes and they just have to go through from a business perspective, sometimes what organisations will do is a dismissal and re-engagement exercise. Now, it's a pretty nuclear option. It's usually, as I say, as a last resort where changes are really fundamental. What that does is kind of sever the link between the old contract and a new one. Ideally, if you're going to be really belt and braces about that sort of process, you'd consider including settlement agreements with all of the employees to compromise any potential unfair dismissal claim. And there's one really good reason why you would do that, which is that tribunals in an unfair dismissal claim have the power to reinstate the employee on their old terms. So you could go through this fantastically planned, sophisticated exercise of dismissing everybody and re-engaging them.
Yeah.
And then those individuals could persuade a tribunal to actually put them back on their old terms anyway. So you've kind of spent a lot of time, money and pain for nothing.
Really important to get those.
Yeah, exactly, if you're concerned about that contingent risk. The other thing to say as well, without getting too kind of mired in the detail of it, if you're going down that dismissal and re-engagement route, just keep an eye on the numbers, because if there's a possibility of that impacting kind of 20 or more people, you need to bear in mind you'll have collective redundancy consultation obligations in respect of those dismissals, even though these aren't redundancies in the kind of common parlance, because these people still have a job. The legislation's pretty broad and would capture that exercise.
I can imagine that sometimes catches people out. out.
Yeah, that's right. And I think sometimes people think of it, but they're already kind of quite far into the process before it occurs. Actually, hang on, we might have to do this dismissal piece for more people than we'd originally envisaged, because actually people just haven't signed up. So it's always better to kind of think through that up front and have a strategy for that. And I mentioned settlement agreements, so I just wanted to kind of be clear on that that's to compromise an unfair dismissal risk in a dismissal and re-engagement. Don't be fooled into thinking, oh, we can just use a settlement agreement actually to vary the terms. We'll just agree with them in a settlement agreement, because it's just going to be void. It doesn't matter what agreement you put it in. If someone's just signing to say, I agree to this change in my terms, if that falls foul of TUPE, it will be void even if it sits within a settlement agreement.
That leads us on rather nicely to our second tricky issue that we're going to discuss in this podcast, dismissals in a TUPE situation. So is it fair to say that dismissals are permitted in a TUPE situation, provided that there is an ETO or economic, technical or organisational reason?
Sort of, but probably not quite. I know that, again, it feels a relatively legalistic answer to that. Coming back to the regulations themselves, what they say is if the sole or principal reason for the dismissal is a TUPE transfer, that is automatically unfair. So those employees which have over 2 years continuous service will have a right to bring a claim in those circumstances in the employment tribunal. The caveat to that is, conversely, is where the reason for the dismissal, the sole or principal reason for the dismissal is an ETO reason, example being a redundancy, then that is a defence to the automatic unfair dismissal. But it's worth bearing in mind that the usual rules about having to follow a fair process when affecting a dismissal will still apply in the way that they apply to ordinary unfair dismissal claims.
And the dismissal for an ETO reason will either be for redundancy or some other substantial reason, depending on circumstances.
Absolutely.
So can a transfer rule deal with redundancies before a transfer? So if it knows the transferee isn't going to need everyone who's in scope to transfer, can the transferor take that on?
That's a question that we get asked a lot in practice, for lots of really good reasons. If we focus on the employees who are assigned to the business or to the services that are changing hands, so they would be in scope to transfer under TUPE if they remained in post up until the point immediately before the transfer. As you said to Ellie, sometimes it's clear that the transferee is not going to retain all of those people. There might be a duplication in roles, and so they know that there's going to have to be a reduction overall. Or, for example, the work might be being offshored, and it's well understood that the individuals are not going to want to move to wherever the services or business is moving to. So it might seem fairer in that circumstance to kind of manage those redundancies before the transfer, rather than shunting everybody to a new employer in the knowledge that they're going to go straight into that kind of redundancy process in their hands.
But there are some restrictions to navigate, aren't there?
Yeah, absolutely, from a legal perspective.
In terms of numbers, you may well be falling back into the well-known collective redundancy consultation obligations. So those are where it's proposed that there'll be 20 or more dismissals at an establishment within a 90-day period. That's the classic trigger for collective redundancy consultation.
And important to say that those obligations are separate and in addition to the TUPE consultation process.
That's right. They will sit side by side, albeit it's worth bearing in mind that the subject matter of both will dovetail between the two. So the conversations where an organisation is envisaging the possibility of 20 or more dismissals, there will be a conversation potentially both within the collective redundancy arena but also within the TUPE consultation arena. But that doesn't remove the fact that they are two separate, distinct consultation obligations.
And if the transferor makes the dismissals before the transfer, those dismissals will be unfair.
Yeah, that's the risk. So just picking up first on the collective consultation side of things, TUPE was helpfully amended to allow that collective process where, as Patrick was saying, is potentially 20 or more people, that collective redundancy process to begin before the transfer, if the transferor and the transferee agree. So that's quite a helpful practical amendment. But if the dismissal itself and the individual redundancy consultation that goes before it, if that is handled before the transfer by the transferor, then that risks the fairness of the ultimate dismissal. And the reason is that the transferor, as the outgoing employer, doesn't have an ETO reason to suspend that dismissal. They're not the ones with the redundancy situation or with the offshoring situation or whatever is the ultimate kind of reason for that person not being needed. The transferee is the one that owns that ETO reason. And case law is really clear on this, that the transferor isn't permitted to borrow the transferee's reason to justify a pre-transfer dismissal. title. And this is an issue for the transferee as well, because if that transferor makes an automatically unfair dismissal because they don't have an ETO to rely on, that liability under CHUPI is going to pass to the transferee. So this is the kind of thing that gets negotiated under the contract. And oftentimes those sorts of risks are dealt with, as I say, by an agreement between the transfer and the transferee. And actually, of course, that can't contract out of the CHUPI obligation. That would be void. But what it can do and what it would commonly do is allocate financial risk if it goes wrong. And oftentimes as well, there'll be settlement agreements with the individual employees, which are sometimes tripartite between transferor, transferee and employee, just to make sure that everyone's kind of on the same page about what's been done, who's responsible for it, where the money is flowing, and there's kind of like a ribbon tied on the whole process.
So there are some useful practical ways of dealing with that.
Yeah.
So finally then, are you envisaging the law on 2P to change at all post-Brexit?
Thanks, Ellie. The eternal question, which is what's the world going to look like?
Yeah.
Come 2019.
Just get a crystal ball out.
In terms of changes which might apply, so much is going to depend on where we end up on the Great Repeal Bill and which powers are going to be retained by government to make changes, either by the government itself or alternatively by the Commons voting on change legislation. I suspect CHUPI is not going to be significantly high on the list of issues which need to be dealt with. It's broadly fit for purpose. Organisations know it. They understand it. We've played with it since 1981. There are criticisms of the way it operates, and some elements of it certainly could be improved. But broadly, we know how it works and the benefit on a number of occasions for CHUPI applying. I think if there was going to be any one particular change which might be pushed for, certainly by business, it could well be the ability to harmonise terms and conditions of employment, because that has, since 81, has been a consistent bugbear. Various governments have tried to amend that particular element of CHUPI without success because it was encumbered by European law. Brexit might provide that flexibility to enable the change.
But it could be a long wait before we see that possibly happen.
I think so.
Thanks very much, Patrick and Kelly. Definitely given us some much needed clarity on two tricky areas of 2P law there.
Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you, Ellie.
Of course, we've got a wealth of detailed guidance on 2P on the site, and a good starting point is our how-to guide on harmonising contractual terms and conditions following a 2P transfer. That brings us to the end of this week's podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back, but until then, it's goodbye from us.